Congratulations, because I think last time we spoke, you were just heading back out to India to continue filming to what we know now is Poachers. Congratulations.
Yes, thank you very much.
And it sounds like that was a long time in the making.
That was we started pre-production in 2020, so that's 3 years. And then it was about a year and a half, 2 years of research and writing prior to that. So it's been 5 years on that project now.
It's funny, I feel like we live in such an age of immediacy now that does feel to me like an extraordinary length of time, but I'm sure to you it maybe doesn't. But how do you feel about, you know, the longevity of something like that? And do you feel like you're ever fighting an urge to sort of get it done faster? Or
no, I love the slow burn, honestly. There was a painting I did. It's actually hanging here, which you can't see it right now. It's just weird. It's going to be hard for you to see, but it's very illustrative. I was in like art school 24 years ago, mm-hmm. and I made this big like collage of movies. Of just movies I loved growing up as a kid. And that painting took me 4 years to do. And I did it, I started in my first year of uni, and then I finished it in my fourth. And it was actually an exercise where I was trying to see how long I could work on something, on one thing, and then bear the fruits of the length of that labor forever. That was what I was trying to
do. As a kind of discipline?
Yeah. And there was a very interesting thing. John Cleese did some lectures, you know, from Monty Python, right? He did some lectures on creativity. He did some studies here. I can't remember if it was Oxford or Cambridge. You can find it online on YouTube. They're really fascinating. He participated in these studies decades ago about creativity in the brain. And one of the conclusions they came up with, which he talks about, is the most creative people are the ones who can handle the anxiety of sitting in a problem longer before coming to a conclusion.
I love that.
Because like you said, it's the age of immediacy. You have a problem, just solve it, and then it's not a problem anymore.
But if you can
actually sit in that problem and come up with the best solution, which might take days or weeks or months or years, it will be a better solution if you can handle that anxiety. And I was putting that into practice years ago to see if I could. And then I also started to realize my own appreciation of movies and art was always involved, not just the idea behind it, but the amount of work that went into it. I loved labor-intensive stuff when you would see it. I would just be humbled by it. Oh my God, somebody did that? Somebody spent, you know, 15 years making this mosaic? Oh my God. The pyramids, you know, somebody spent all that time. Or the cathedrals, the European Gothic cathedrals, took 200 years to build. That idea that the architect who began it would not be alive to see it finished, and that was part of the discipline. And then what's left over is a landmark piece of art, architectural art, for eternity.
Amazing legacy. I guess legacy comes into that too. And
it does in a way. I think legacy has now been kind of shattered because the work we do is so disposable. No matter how much work you put into it and how much meaning it has, people will forget about it in a few weeks. So it's like, oh, damn it. We make films so that they last forever, but good luck staying in people's consciousnesses.
And do you think you find that there has to be a sort of grandiose end to the end product? Because the things that you've just mentioned, like pyramids and cathedrals, they're very impressive, you know, immediately. And I suppose there's a question in whether the labor has to be evident in the end result.
I think labor will be evident in the end result in a certain manner, but I think it should unfold in a very easy manner. So, for example, my favorite sports players are the ones who make it look easy. You know, if you're catching a ball that's been hit in cricket or baseball or wherever, and the person doesn't dive to catch it, they just float there and get it. And you're like, how do they do it every time? Well, because they've been training for like 20 years to anticipate and move that fast. That's how it should be. It should look easy. So my hope is that as the work unfolds, nobody's thinking about, wow, so much work went into this. You're just thinking about the content. You're so immersed in it. But it's one of the reasons, with Delhi Crime, that last series was, you know, essentially a 7-hour film full of ideas. And Poacher is similar thing, 8-episode series, but full of ideas, all done Like, I've written, researched, written, and directed the whole thing as a one. And my hope is by the end, people are moved by the totality of it and the density of what they've just experienced. So maybe in hindsight, they might look at it and say, wow, a lot must have gone into it, but not while they're watching it. I don't want them to be out of it. Mm-hmm. I just think it's the most, when I watch something, I'm humbled when it's a mix of incredibly new ideas or innovative take on old ideas mixed with a labor and discipline that you couldn't just do overnight. Somebody really, really, really had to want to do this. You know, I get humbled by it.
And I was really interested to read about your journey into poachers, because I can see the poster for India in a Day behind you, because from what I read, there was an excerpt of a kind of ivory raid that came yes. into that project, which was then what led you to making this a much bigger thing in and of itself. Talk to me a bit about that.
Yeah. No, it was, I mean, yeah, while I was doing that film, because we received thousands of pieces of footage from one day in India, people happened to shoot. Like, that was the assignment that we had given out for anyone who wanted to participate. And so all that footage came in, and we spent months just culling through it and watching stuff. I had a team of people watching stuff. I was watching as much as I could, the editor as well. And we kept going through everything. And then one piece of footage, which I can't remember if I encountered it or somebody encountered it and showed it to me, was like, you know, police and other people, undercover people, just breaking down a door or opening a door actually with a lock and then kind of going inside to a small house in Delhi and just finding all these boxes, and then they unwrap and open the boxes and pulling out pieces of ivory. I'm like, what the hell is this? Like, this is crazy. It was the only crime scene we got images of. And I just figured, I tried to put it in the movie, but then I'm like, I can't create a context for a crime scene all of a sudden. I need to be given more than that, than just a clip in a tapestry of images. And so I just called the NGO that had uploaded the footage. It was a person at the NGO, and it was like a marketing person there. And I said, what is this? And she said, oh, we've just done the biggest ivory raid in the history of India after a 9-month investigation, and it happened to be your shoot day, so we thought we'd send it to you. I'm like, this is really something. I want to know more about this, because I really believe in conservation and what you guys are up to, but just give me like 4 or 5 years and then I'll come back and get the lowdown on it and then do a whole thing on it. So that's
and
do you think
they thought, oh yeah, he'll never be back?
Or
do you
think I'm sure they did. Oh, I'm sure they're like, yeah, great. But then I said, by the way, and I hate to say this to them, I'm like, I'm sorry. What I can do is, if you, without context, is just give me cute elephants or cute rhinos. And then there's a scene there, they gave me some stuff of rescued baby rhinos, elephants. And I'm like, great, I can use that. And then I used that as also an excuse to stay in touch with them. I was always in touch with them. So every time I went back to Delhi for work or research while I was doing Delhi crime, I would go to the NGO and I would say, can I help you on something, on anything? And at one point they're like, we have all this footage, we don't know what to do with, we've over the last 20 years and we're having a fundraising event. And I said, give it to me. So I edited it into a 5-minute film that they could use to raise funds on. And the next time I was in Delhi, I went back and said, anything else I can do for you? I'm not finished my project, so I can't start the poaching one, but anything else I can do with you on the side? And they said, can you go out into a forest reserve and train locals on how to use their phones to capture elephant corridors, so that when elephants are walking through it, the government can see it's being used, and then help preserve those corridors? And I said, yeah, of course. So I went and did some workshops with people in the jungle. So I think, proving my fealty to them.
Absolutely. Oh, how fantastic. And so nice that you have had that relationship all the way through. And it must be amazing for them now to see it come to fruition. Although it hasn't aired yet, am I right?
No, it hasn't. It hasn't aired yet. It'll come soon, early next year, globally. Right now, I mean, we showed the first 3 episodes of Sundance last year, mm-hmm. and then we sold it after that. So it'll be on a streamer, I think probably February, but the team has seen it. All the people involved have seen it. The real people involved have seen it. And I think they're very moved by it. And I think, yeah, I think to an extent they're like, wow, we can't believe you did it. Like, you came back and spent a year or two with us just researching then, 2019, 2020, and then went and did this, so.
Well, I'm so excited to see it, but if you're allowed to, I'm so intrigued about what real wildlife crime fighters do. Are you allowed to reveal anything of the sort of practicalities of that?
Yeah, I mean, look, a lot of it is in the series, but It is literally like a cop or a spy even, but they just operate. They operate in a very similar way. The ones I'm showing are obviously in India, so they have their own ad hoc way of doing things. Mm-hmm. And it's a different kind of system there, but it literally is. It's detecting and apprehending people like they would a manhunt in any other police case or military case. The difference is they're doing it because they think they're saving the world, which I happen to agree with them. So they're doing it on behalf of a species that has no voice. So they feel very justified in doing what they're doing, and they'll do anything. I mean, in some cases, I'm not speaking about necessarily people I've been working with, but I've seen wildlife crime fighters who happily torture people mm-hmm. if they think they're going to save a species. And that's crazy. I mean, that kind of discipline and that desire and that verve, I'm attracted to that. I'm like, holy crap, you believe so much in saving the world. This is how far you'll go. I think that's worth examining, for better or for worse. And certainly, there's never been a certain type of depiction of animals on screen, ever. Because I don't believe in wrangling real animals. I mean, with the exception of dogs and cats. But beyond that, I don't believe in using real animals. And in the series, there's animals everywhere, including elephants. Mm-hmm. Elephants getting shot in the head and really going into details, but you have to recreate that stuff. So that is utilizing the best talent, film talent in the world for a very specific end, which I believe is very noble. Combining all that together, I think, can create something really magical. That's what we've tried to do.
And is that then why you decided that drama was the right lens for it? Because of course it's based on true stories and true people, and yet it is dramatized, as opposed to, because you have done documentary work and stuff as well sure. in your repertoire. What's that decision-making process like for you?
I just think drama is more immersive. I think with documentaries, you can see somebody else's life, find a point of relation in it. With drama, it's you put yourself in the main character's shoes. You literally will transpose yourself in it more so. That's what I find I do in films. And so I feel it's a more effective way of emotionally impacting people, by and large, with exceptions, of course. And secondly, when I'm researching these things, I find nobody wants to talk when you have a recorder, whether it's audio or video. If I'm just sitting there with a notepad and saying, I'm not going to quote anything you say literally, I'm going to record everything you say by handwriting it, and then I'm going to get an actor to say it. And they're like, yeah, okay, whatever, fine. That's fine. So I actually get the truth out of the subjects I'm interviewing more when they know they're not, I can hide them if I really need to. So I find it's a more truthful way, actually, of depicting what happened.
That's so interesting. I can see that, but in a way it feels counterintuitive because, of course, that's not the narrative that we're given about what those two art forms do.
Uh-huh.
It's something that feels less intimidating, I guess, as well.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly. If I was going to interview you off camera, not recording something, and say, okay, Aaron, I will write it all down, and then before I write it into a script, I'll show you what I have. And then once it's in the script, I'll show you what's there. And if you're not comfortable with anything, let me know and I'll work around it. And with that, it's rare that it happens because I'm very clear about my intention, about what I want to depict. But in Poacher, for example, there were poachers I was speaking to who were hiding from poaching gangs because they had kind of turned against them. So this was like secret meetings in the jungle. And I said, I'm going to depict you and depict the words that you're giving me right now, but I'm never going to reveal your name. And so as a result, and this guy's life was in danger, and his family's life. And he's like, yeah, great. That's totally fine. I'm comfortable with that.
You chose to produce this independently. Why was that?
Because I needed the ability to explore in the creation of it, the shooting of it and the editing of it, that I felt would not necessarily come with a commission. Where when commissions come and the money is coming from a source that's going to be broadcasting it, you know, there are certain conditions attached to that usually. There's a certain oversight, which sometimes can, obviously oftentimes benefits the project. But in this case, I felt that I needed to have a little bit of time to explore without oversight. to get to the final version of this. Because I was establishing something that I actually looked at it as a creation of a new subgenre, because we've had crime fighting shows and true crime shows. We've never had one with wildlife crime. So because it was a creation of a subgenre, I needed to figure out how that would work dramatically, especially in the edit. I needed time. And you don't get a lot of time when you have a commission. It's like, no, we haven't broadcast it. You better hurry. Having said that, once I had established it, and the producers who financed it were very, very accommodating about this. I mean, it was an ideal match for that. But once we had it and then we sold it, now season two would be a commission season, because now somebody else, now a streamer actually has the rights. And that's okay, because I've established the characters, I've established a style, I've established a tone, mood, atmosphere, pacing. I know what to do now. But just to establish that, I needed space.
Nice to feel that you've got full creative license.
It's the producers, QC Entertainment. They're guys out of LA, and they gave me that license.
It sounds like you're very drawn to conservation, and indeed your last series, Extrapolations, was also kind of based around climate topics and climate change and impending doom, more so in that one, it felt.
Yeah.
What draws you to that as a subject matter, and why feel like filmmaking and storytelling is the lens that you want to use for that?
Because I find it, I mean, filmmaking and storytelling via filmmaking is kind of all I know how to do right now. So I have to do something. But I find it difficult to justify the amount of resources that are required for filmmaking, to use those resources for just pure entertainment and diversion. I can't justify that anymore. I have to give it, if I'm going to raise those resources successfully, I need to be able to do it to some positive end socially, because there's so many issues in the world. Just pick one, you know. These happen to be ones that I feel very strongly about. They require, I believe, an unlimited amount of attention. I can't think of anything bigger than species extinction. I don't think any of our brains can. Species extinction, I think, is a concept that we're not hardwired to really comprehend what it means. And so I feel like it merits discussion. And by the way, I like watching other stuff that is entertainment and views for diversion. We all need it, but I just can't justify making it. That's why.
And was that always true, or do you feel like that sort of developed with you?
I mean, if you saw the painting, most of those things were like fantasy, adventure. Half of those movies are about nothing. They're just about what they are about, kind of fun adventures. I mean, they have themes and heart and soul, of course, but it's not necessarily about anything bigger than what they're presenting as character drama. but no, as I started off 20 years ago or 22 years ago, I didn't know what to talk about. I was just a, you know, graduating student who probably very narcissistic and just wanted to talk about stuff that was on my mind, and I had very limited worldview. And then as I grew and evolved and spent much more time in India and started to realize this is the lopsided world we live in for so many reasons. And I think also as a Canadian, I feel I'm very lucky to be a Canadian, because you grow up in a society that I feel like has taken the best of every other system and adapted it for its citizens. And to be the beneficiary of that, as I grew and traveled more and more, I realized, I would be insulting the privilege of growing up in that environment if I didn't try and use it to make things better around the world.
I think it's still so encouraging to hear an established, successful filmmaker like yourself say that you weren't there immediately, because I think as an emerging artist, you know, in any form, it's so hard, I think, to carry the pressure of feeling like you've got to arrive at the place that you'll end up immediately.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like you've got to have it all figured out when you start out, because that's how you sort of justify giving your life to a creative
Yes.
career or pursuits, because it does feel like it's a harder path to tread because you don't, it feels more unreliable. So I think, yeah, thank you. It's really nice to...
No, not at all. And if you look at the evolution of people who whose work you love, whether it's art or film or music, you'll see the evolution of the thought process. And the, I mean, generally, the people I love are older now, right? They're established. They've been around for 30, 40 years practicing their work. And you see the evolution and the maturity of it. And sometimes that works. Sometimes there's something in their brazen, youthful attitude that is incredible. But certainly what's really interesting, like if you look at musical artists who've been around for 20, 30, 40 years, pretty much all of them are going into social issues or climate now. Every single one in their 60s or 70s are realizing, oh man, this is what we're doing for our children and grandchildren now. I want to talk about this. Look at Peter Gabriel, look at U2. It's all social issues, right? It's really interesting to me. And I just think if you're a thinking, feeling person who's in touch with stuff, if you are just speaking about yourself after 30 years of practice, there might be a problem.
I also want to talk to you about the sort of age-old debate about truth and authenticity in filmmaking. Contextually, of course, we're working in an industry of artifice, and the very nature of being an actor is to be somebody that you're not. And yet we're also existing in a society that must be sensitive to this concept of truthful representation.
Yes.
As well. And I just wanted to hear how conscious casting actors who feel close to the heritage or lived experiences that you're working with, how important is that for you?
Very. It's crucial, in fact. So there's obviously several levels of artifice in a film, and every aspect of a film is artificial in its construction. However, if I've done the work on the research, especially if it's depicting true people, if I've done the work on the research, which you take years to get right, and then I've managed to dramatically depict that through a script, which would take several more years, I've basically, through labor, muscled my way through that. On paper, we've got it. We've got the truth of it on paper now. Now we've got to translate that, like you said, with a bunch of other artists. And I actually take a cue from my favorite director on this one. It's a guy named Peter Weir, he's an Australian director, he's a master. And he said years ago, and if you look him up, you'll see the films he's done, or many that you've seen or at least heard of. And he said something once about casting in one of his interviews, which I heard years ago and I never forgot it. And he said that when he's casting an actor, he basically considers himself a private detective who's looking for the true identity of somebody. And everyone who comes into audition is a liar who's claiming to be that person. One person is telling the truth, and you have to figure out who that is. And every time I think about that, it all of a sudden becomes very easy. Because then sometimes some of the people are really good liars, and you're like, wow, that person's amazing. And you're like, it was a great audition and they gave it their all and da-da-da, but something is just... And then the next person walks in and they don't even try. And there's like, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, oh, you're the person. Effortlessly, you are the person. So it has to do with who's appropriate and appropriateness of truth. And once you feel that and you get it, and I think about it in that manner, it makes my life way easier because those people just show up and speak. And then I can focus on the things that need to be focused on in consultation with everyone else. Like the movement of the camera, like the lighting, like the design, like, because there's artifice there, but I want the viewer to feel like it's not, even though so much is there. So that takes constant management and effort every day. But if I don't have to worry about the acting, which is the most important aspect of the whole thing in directing, that has made my life easier.
And it comes right back round to the idea of someone working really hard to make it look really easy. Mm-hmm. When did you know you wanted to be a filmmaker?
Oh, I think it was 3 or 4. Yeah. I remember the moment. I was playing Lego and I was watching Star Wars. And I had this revelation that the guy on screen I was watching was also Indiana Jones. And I'm like, what? Like, this is not real? That's the same guy, except in that role he's got stubble, and this he's clean shaven, and his hair is kind of more frazzled. What? And I remember I was sitting in front of the TV, and I had a whole pile of Lego, and I was watching the movie for the 100th time, and I just kind of stopped, and I think it was 3.5 or 4 years old, I stopped and I looked at the pile and I'm like, that means he got up and went to work. That means it's not real. That means everyone else is working. That means nothing is real. That means the music is not real. And somebody made, oh my God, this is amazing. People actually did this thing. It's not just like it's happening in space. And I was like, I want in.
And that was an exciting revelation for you, was it? Rather than, like, to me, listening to that now, that sounds like a wild existential crisis.
Oh, no, it'd be like a shock. Yeah, I'd be like, oh my God, Santa Claus is not real. What? It's that kind of thing. But no, this was like, oh my God, and the music. There's a really funny anecdote somebody said once, several years ago, I read it somewhere, where somebody said to a filmmaker, well, if it's a sealed off cave, where's the light coming from? And the guy's like, same place as the music.
That's great.
It's that kind of thing. I perceived it as a kid. I'm like, there's music on this. And that's like a fucking tuba or something. Somebody's playing this thing. And they slapped it on somehow. And that's what I'm seeing and feeling. So I'm like, oh, I want in on this. I want to figure this out.
Do you feel like you have, when you're making a new project, do you feel like you have any non-negotiables, any rules that you live by?
Yes. My biggest non-negotiable is if it's a story based on truth, when I'm researching it, part of the building of the trust I have with the real subjects is at some point to cross that barrier into a place I need to get to with them, I'll make promises that I will not depict your story if I don't depict it truthfully. So the truth of what you're telling me, I will represent. And if I can't, I won't do it. And that's a very difficult promise to hold all the way through the filmmaking process, especially when you get producers, financiers, commissioners, streamers, whatever it is. Because then you have to hold that promise sacred, but it's not like it's enshrined in the contracts going forward. But then I have to ensure at each stage, whether it's the first contract I sign with the financier or producer, or the second with the streamer or distributor, whatever it is. At each stage, I make it very clear, if you force me to break these sets of promises that I've made, I will leave the project. And on everything I've worked on, that has been respected. And I think that the people I work with, including the financiers and money people, who's obviously in many ways for primary interest is to make profit, they recognize, oh my God, the bedrock of this project is something that's ethical. So great. And that makes me happy too. I think people like being a part of something like that. And this day and age, it's also quite fashionable to be part of something like that. But those are my deal breakers, definitely.
But I think also such credit to you that you are so clear and upfront about those ambitions and those, like you say, deal breakers before you start. Because I think that's then very easy and clear for everyone to go, oh, okay, I know where I stand. Yeah. And the trust is established.
Totally. And at any stage, if somebody says, well, why don't we try this in this scene? I'm like, and I do the math. I'm like, that would get into gray area of what I said I wouldn't do. So no, not good for me.
And if you had to give advice to someone who thinks they have a powerful story to tell, what would it be?
I heard something last week, actually, from a great filmmaker, Errol Morris, a documentary filmmaker, where he actually had an anecdote about this. And I would say to that same filmmaker, if you have a very powerful story, find an equally powerful way to finance it. The economics of how you do things will enable you to do them, will buy you the freedom to do them properly. And if you do it responsibly, it will give you the longevity to develop your voice. Somebody starting off, like you said earlier, they don't necessarily know their voice and they need to work in a manner, they have to play the long game. That the work that they do, first of all, they cannot compromise on the first project in any capacity with what they believe, because compromises will come later on. If you're compromising the first one, you've just basically stabbed yourself in the foot on day one. They'll be limping, time to limp later on when we get old. So you have to establish the ground rules of what you're willing to work on and how you're willing to work on day one for yourself. But you have to think about the long game, that if you are in this for your life, your voice will develop over time and give it that freedom to develop over time. At the same time, once you get into pre-production on a project, if you're lucky enough to, like I always do, I always assume at that stage is the last thing I'm ever going to make. So I don't, when I'm actually in it doing it, I don't actually say, oh, I'll phone it in, or, you know what, fine, I'll compromise this time. No. This is it. This is the only chance that the world has given me, and the money and resources and people, manpower, to do this. I may never get it again. So really treat this as if now it is your last thing you'll ever do.
That's really nice. There's no, I'll do it better next time.
No.
And what about you? What's next for you? Do you have time for a holiday?
Or No. I've been, so the long game I've been playing, the biggest long game is on the life of Gandhi. I've been researching that and writing that for almost a decade now. And I'm on the cusp of pushing it over the edge into prep and production. That's the one that I'm trying to build a huge, huge legacy around, because it's a project worth doing. So I'm at the cusp of breaking the back of that one.